are now going to listen to KAZ iBook Review with Hopeton Hay.
Gar Anthony Haywood is an award-winning crime novelist, but his latest novel, In Things Unseen, departs from the genre with the tale of a miracle. It's about a little boy that died tragically in an auto accident. And one day, he's back in his bed asleep 8 months later because his mother had faith enough to pray for this to happen. But the interesting thing about the story is that when he returns, only four people in the world know that he actually ever died. His mother, his father, the man who drove the car that killed him, and his teacher. While the mother accepts his return as a miracle, the other three question their sanity, their faith, or the lack thereof. Gar Anthony Haywood is the Seamus and Anthony Award-winning author of 13 crime novels. Gar Anthony Haywood, welcome back to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you, Hopeton. Very, very pleased to be here. Thank you.
So your latest book was an interesting choice for a novel. I first became familiar with your work almost 25 years or so ago with the couple that was traveling around in the RV, the retired police captain, Joe, I think, Doty and Dottie Lauder.
Dottie Lauder, yes.
Yeah, and then I read some of your other work, so I was always a big fan of your crime fiction work. But with this novel, it was a bit of a turn. Talk a little bit about sort of this novel of my characterization, not yours, sort of a novel of, in my mind at least, of faith and of miracles and the tenuousness of miracles and relationships that are afraid that in some cases can't be repaired, in some cases can be repaired. So it was a bit of a different type of novel that we got from you, Gar. So talk a little bit about that decision to do this novel.
Sure. And we're talking about In Things Unseen. And you're right, it's a deliberate departure from what I've done in the past. You know, I was raised a Catholic, a good Catholic boy for the most part. Became a born-again Christian, per se, 3 years ago, somewhere in that neighborhood. So my faith in God and in Jesus Christ has always been a part of who I am and where I'm coming from. But I've never made a point of mentioning any of that in my work. I've touched upon Gunner's faith, my private investigator, Aaron Gunner, who I've written 7 books about now. From time to time, we'll touch on the subject of where he's at in terms of belief. But I've never made an issue of questions of faith, particularly in my writing to this point. And I think I just reached the point in my own private life where I felt like it was time to write something that was essentially about that, some kind of take on what I believe to be true in terms of whether God is real and whether or not God plays any active role in our day-to-day lives, whether there's such a thing as a miracle, whether it ever has been, whether they continue to happen today. So In Things Unseen essentially is my response to that need to explore those questions in a contemporary setting and hopefully in an entertaining way. As briefly as I can put it, it is a novel about a miracle. It's about a little boy that is resurrected from the dead, essentially because his mother had faith enough to pray for this to happen. He died tragically in an auto accident in a local park in Seattle, Washington. And one day he's back in his bed asleep. His mother finds him back and no worse for wear, so to speak. But the interesting thing, I think, about the story is that only 4 people in the world know that he actually ever died. So when he comes back, God has tweaked the world, so to speak, in such a way that only 4 people in the world remember that this little boy that died in the first place. So that would be his mother, his father, the little old Jewish man whose car went out of control in the park and killed him, and his teacher who loved this little boy almost as much as his parents did. So it's really a story of what do you do with the impossible when you're confronted in contemporary times with something that absolutely cannot be explained. What do you do with that?
And let me jump in here real quick.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
I thought what was interesting is that we have an atheist, an agnostic, and the deeply religious, and one that lost that belief because of the father lost the belief to some degree because of the death of the son. So I thought you providing those three different perspectives and the struggles each one has. Well, Diane doesn't have a struggle. So the mother doesn't have a struggle at all. She believes, she accepts it. The teacher, Laura is the atheist. Her fiance is the atheist. And so there is a mountain to climb, and we won't reveal what happens when trying to climb that mountain in terms of her just not believing it. And then you have Milton, who is the man who drove the car that killed the boy, and his struggle. He's an agnostic. So talk a bit about giving those three different perspectives. And so this is a novel that reaches us because you don't just give the one perspective, but you give us an opportunity to see all three perspectives.
Yeah, and that was obviously something that I was intent upon doing from the very beginning. I wasn't interested in writing a novel of faith only for people who have faith. I don't see the point in that. You're kind of preaching to the choir when you do that. You know, if you really want to explore this question, you know, is God real? Could this thing really happen because he wanted it to occur? You would want to explore that question. You have to explore it from all angles. And, you know, to me, from the perspective of the atheist and the agnostic, those were the most interesting passages for me to write because I have to place myself in their head. And I have to, and again, you know, the key question is, what does anybody, even people who believe in God and believe in miracles and believe in Jesus and whatever, even people with faith would struggle on some level with the impossible. If you're given a situation that just cannot be explained rationally, except to say God made this happen, you know, what do you do with that? Obviously, like you're right, Diane, the mother, this is what she wanted all along, although she didn't expect it to happen in this way. She didn't really care how it happened, but she's just this kind of, she's struggling with the way it occurs almost as much as everyone else. And that, you know, four people know that he died, but nobody else does. I mean, that's an adjustment for her alone. But again, getting back to your question, you know, I wanted to get into the head of the atheist. What does an atheist do? Someone who's committed to the idea that God is a concept, that it's, he or she is not real. It's not a real thing. And they certainly don't do anything to, involve themselves in our lives here on earth. What does someone like that do when they're faced with something that they can't explain any other way? What's their struggle like? So, yeah, that, you know, again, I made an absolute point of wanting to view the same question from various angles, from the perspective of various people in different places in terms of faith, to see how they would react. And to me, that was really the point of writing the book, is to explore that question and to see, you know, for myself, you know, what would my character do under these circumstances? One of my favorite parts in the book is when Milton Weissman, the old man who actually killed a little boy, he goes to see his rabbi. Because he doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't understand what's real. He thinks he might be losing his mind. And he wants to see what his rabbi's perspective would be on this. And I love that whole conversation. That's one of the favorite passages I've ever written in anything. Just that the way that conversation unfolds, the questions that Milton asks and the kinds of answers he gets, it speaks again to why I wrote the book, which is to try to answer a very key question about faith from a lot of different angles, not just my own.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Gar Anthony Haywood. We're talking about his latest novel, In Things Unseen. Now, I'm the father of three daughters.
Yes.
Of which two were adult daughters. And so I really loved the way that the daughters watched out for Milton. And I will make my daughters, my adult daughters, read this book so that they understand what their responsibility could be to me as a father.
That's funny. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm a father too. I'm a father of four kids. There was a point in my life where I thought I would never get out of the habit of having children because I love having kids so much. But yeah, those characters are interesting to write too, Hopeton, because as you probably noticed, they are distinctly different, as our children always are, right? Is that you've got one daughter that thinks this way and you've got another daughter that counterbalances her with something, with a totally different approach and attitude. And so in Milton's case, one of his daughters is like rock solid, you know, and she's got his back 110%. And the other one is like a nag, you know, is always on his back, you know, constantly worried about him. You know, she breaks into tears just thinking that he's lost his mind and it's time to put him in a hospital and that sort of thing. So, those characters were fun to write as well. But again, they were very helpful and useful in terms of helping Milton figure out, what to believe, you know, and how to react to what he's experiencing. He has to bounce his, what he's actually seeing and hearing off of somebody. And naturally their reaction is, oh, dad's lost. For the most part, dad's losing his mind and he needs help.
Well, I kept thinking he's only 70 or 69. He's not that old. It was like, why aren't you treating him this way? I'll be vibrant at 70.
Yeah. Well, that question is funny you said, because that question takes us back to where you started my introduction with the Loudermilks. I don't know if you recall this, but Joe and Dottie Loudermilk, when I wrote the first books, they were in their late 50s, mid to late 50s. And I actually had referred to them as elderly. And boy, I got hate mail like you wouldn't believe, man. It's like, you know, and of course I was writing from the perspective of someone who was just entering his late 30s, mid to late 30s, I think, at the time. So, right. Yeah, I mean, 55, 60 years old, that looks like elderly from there. But, I hear what you're saying. I think it's fair to say, though, that I think if you're in your late 70s, which Milton is, that there are people that, are losing some of their faculties. And, you know, it's the great fear of our time, I think, for older people with Alzheimer's and dementia. You know, you forget a name, or you forget, you know, the star of a TV show that you used to love, and you're almost certain that you're headed down that path. You know, it's the great nightmare. And so that is kind of what Milton is dealing with as he's experiencing this real life miracle. Is this thing real, or am I actually headed down that path that I've been afraid of going down for a long, long time? So that's part of his particular struggle, and as well as his daughter's as well.
Yeah, much to the destruction of a computer.
Well, you know, that's me living vicariously through my character. I'm sure we've all had those moments where we just want to just take the laptop and throw it through the window and watch a car roll over it because it's not doing what we want it to do. So yeah, that is something that Milton does at one point. Again, in his struggle to understand what's going on, because since you mentioned it, what's happening in that particular scene is that, you know, Milton has been living with the guilt of killing this little boy for months. And what he was doing basically to remind himself that he'd done this terrible thing was he would look stories up on his computer every night just to remind himself this had happened and that this is something that he has to live with and deal with and hopefully become a better person because of it, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, once the little boy is brought back to life, those stories no longer exist. He can't find them on his computer because, again, you know, God has changed the world in such a way that little boy never died. So there are no stories about him, you know, being killed in the park by Milton Weissman.
Let's talk about the redemption, because for me, the story was much also about redemption. Milton, Allison, to provide too, especially Allison, a redemption arc for a reporter.
Yes. Yeah. Allison Hope is kind of the fifth wheel in the story in that she's not somebody that knew anything about the little boy dying, but she got called into the story. She found somebody, a posting on online social media that referred
to- let's not forget FloJo.
Oh yeah, her girlfriend. Flo. Her girlfriend Flo was reading something online about the story. Essentially, what happens is, very early in the book, when the little boy comes back to life, her mother Diane just basically sends him to school. You know, she decides that, you know, this is the way it's meant to be. Obviously, nobody knows that he's died. She doesn't understand why God has decided to bring him back in this way, but she feels like it must be her job to pretend like nothing happened. And so she sends him off to school, and he doesn't remember anything about dying himself. He, as far as he knows, you know, yesterday, you know, the day before he died was yesterday. So she sends him to school. He goes to school, walks into his classroom, and his teacher, again, Laura, who does remember that he was killed in this accident, she completely freaks out. You know, she jumps into a screaming jag and crawls into a corner. And naturally, this causes a great deal of chaos at the school because nobody knows why she's freaking out in this way. And getting back to your point, so FloJo, Allison, the reporter's girlfriend, reads something about this teacher freaking out because she thinks a little dead boy returned from the dead and walked into her classroom. And Allison sees a story. Allison is, again, she's calls herself a journalist, but she's a struggling journalist. She hasn't made really a dime doing what she loves for a very long time. And she's desperate to do something, to write something that will get her career back on track. So when FloJo, her girlfriend, reads her this story, she immediately latches onto it and believes this is the story that she's she was born to tell. And so she begins investigating what happened at the school, et cetera, et cetera. And so in doing that, in her pursuit of this story that she thinks she's writing, she becomes involved in the story of these four people and this little boy who has been returned from the dead back to the living.
So real quick, I did want to say, as soon as you had the character Flo, it just made me think of the Olympian who later got in trouble, FloJo. So yeah, that was the first thought. So for me, that was sort of like, wow, FloJo. That was the first thought that came to my mind. So for me, that was a little humorous for me personally. Sure. But the relationship between Flo and Allison is interesting because Flo seems to measure Allison only by how successful she is. And after struggling, as some people will tell you, sometimes you hit a lull in your career. You may struggle, especially as a writer.
Yep.
I mean, it's not like all the opportunities are there with the rise of social media, the demise of newspapers, the demise of weekly newspapers.
Sure.
So Allison is struggling to survive, and she can see her relationship with Flo just starting to fall apart. And it seems to be driven because Allison is not successful, and that lack of success appears to have affected her partner's love of her.
Yeah, and that happens. You know, I can speak personally to that. You know, I think I've experienced that myself at least once, possibly twice. It does happen. I mean, there are all kinds of things that can contribute to the deterioration of a relationship. And as much as we like to think that, you know, love alone is sufficient to keep a relationship alive, there are a lot of other things that go into it. And one of those things is, you know, there has to be a certain equilibrium between partners for a relationship to thrive. And I think in any way, financially or professionally, whatever it may be, anytime that equilibrium gets way out of whack and somebody is way more something than the other partner, that can prove to be problematic. And in the case of Allison and Flo, it's a matter of professional success. It's not so much about money as much as it is about being a success in the career that you've chosen. And so for Flo, it's problematic that she can't be as proud of her partner, Allison, as she would like to be in terms of where she is in her life and what kind of success she's made of her career choices.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Scar Anthony Haywood. He is the author of the novel In Things Unseen. Well, talk a little bit about how you decided to frame the different relationships in the novel, the relationship between Michael and Diane. At the beginning of the novel, they have split up because of the gulf caused by the death of their son. Flo and Allison, they're on the ropes because of the lack of professional success of Allison at the time. And actually, Laura has a pretty good relationship with her boyfriend. They're both avowed atheists. And then we could talk about Milton and the relationships he has with his daughters. One is more accepting than the other, but they both in their own way really work hard to take care of him and do what they can to help him out. So talk about your decision on how you were going to frame all these different relationships.
Well, you know, one of the things I was very adamant about when I first started writing this was I didn't want to write. You're familiar with my work in the past. You know, essentially what I do. And I would like to say that for the most part, I don't make any choices strictly for the artificial, for artificial reasons. In other words, one thing that, you know, was kind of challenging for me in this book is there, I use a certain amount of language that wouldn't, you know, be welcome in certain circles, because I believe that's how people talk. I wanted to make sure that every character that I created in this book resonated as a real contemporary character. Okay. And so in terms of what they said, the kind of language they used from time to time in the book, I feel like, I was making choices that are all about realism. And so in terms of the relationships they have with people, I wanted to make these people three-dimensional. And, you know, that means, yeah, the teacher has a partner and the partner is in line with her thinking in terms of faith, because probably it's very, very likely she would choose someone that feels the same way she does about whether God is real and what role religion should have in your life, et cetera, et cetera. Michael and Diane's, you know, I get as much as I feel is necessary into the day-to-day, issues of relationships with all my characters. And so I wanted especially to have, everybody should have somebody, again, to bounce their feelings off. And, you know, because you have to have the conversations necessary to convey what they're going through. You don't want to constantly be in somebody's head, you know, throughout the pit. Most of what we learn about what Diane is thinking and what Michael is thinking and what Laura is thinking, et cetera, is conveyed via dialogue. And so you have to give these characters people to have those conversations with. So, you know, yes, Diane, part of what I wanted to deal with in terms when you loss of a child. Yes, of course, it's important to explore what it feels like to be a mother who has lost a child. But I don't think we've seen enough of what it's like for a father. You know, yes. I definitely knew from the get that Michael was going to be a primary character here because I wanted to examine what it's like for the father to lose a child, an only child. So Michael was an important character. I wanted Laura again to have somebody that, you know, she could bounce her because again, Laura being the atheist, her struggle is the greatest. I think it's fair to say that being someone that's absolutely resigned to the idea that there's no such thing as God, confronted with this outrageously impossible reality that she's suddenly living in, you know, what in the heck does she do with that? She has to have somebody to bounce her reactions off of. And of course, her boyfriend or her fiance is the character for that. And then again, Milton, you know, I wanted to explore the relationship that he has with his children. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is that Milton was actually an alcoholic.
Oh, yeah.
He was a raging alcoholic.
A bad husband, too.
And a bad husband. Yeah, his wife died. He's a widower. His wife died before he ever came correct. And so on the day that he actually killed I was crazy enough. I've forgotten my own character's name. What's the little boy's name? Remind me.
Adrian.
Yeah, Adrian. There you go. Adrian Edwards. On the day that he kills Adrian, he decided not to drink that day. He usually goes to the park and reads the paper habitually. This is what he does every day. And on this particular day, he just said, you know what, I'm not drinking. And he goes and he has this accident without a drop of liquor in his system. This is why he's not in jail, you know, in prison somewhere. You know, I wanted him to explore what it's like to try to be this better person, you know, and to understand, like, why did this happen to me, you know? And again, he needs somebody to talk to, somebody to bounce ideas off of, somebody that can actually enter new ideas into his head about what may be going on. And his daughters and his son-in-law fill that role.
So was the experience of writing this book, well, not even so. I mean, I imagine the experience had to be very different from writing all your other books.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because it took me forever to actually get started on it in earnest. I mean, the book, I think I had the idea for the book probably 9 years ago, if not longer than that. But it wasn't, I just didn't feel like I was ready to get started and write it. And my books are a grind, as you know, Hopeton, you know, if you're waiting for me to deliver my next book, you know, you'll be waiting a year and a half. You know, it takes me forever to grind these things out. And, but when I finally got started in this thing, it just flew out of me. It really did. It took about 8 months to write it, which was like light years for me. So, you know, yeah, it was quite a different experience. Obviously I feel very, very proud of it. It sounds corny to say, you know, it's the book that God wanted me to write, you know, but I feel like on some level that is true, that, you know, there's a message here that I think I was intended to deliver. And I think I've done that. And hopefully the book has made me a better Christian and a better person.
I'll tell you, there are points at the book, and I won't reveal it, where it's something happens, and then all of a sudden your mind is shifting. So there's tension and there is surprise. It's not, the narrative is full of surprises.
Well, it's supposed to be. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first author that's ever joined you on the show that has said that, you know, one of the greatest, impulses for writing for me was the Twilight Zone. You know, the Twilight Zone had always created the framework for almost anything I write, in the sense that anything you write should have multiple surprises in it, especially at the end. You know, you need a payoff, and the payoff should surprise you on some level. And throughout, you should have your expectations totally dashed. And that's what I try to do in anything I write. And in this, of course, that it was definitely the intent. You know, I didn't want to write anything that was going to be predictable. You know, oh, okay, this is this character. I know what this character is going to think and how this character. Oh, I know what this character, because of who this character is, I know what they're going to do with this, you know, that kind of thing. I wanted to avoid any sense of that. And so, yeah, I hopefully built in a number of surprises in the book where it's suspenseful. You know, it's a little stressful at times. Hopefully there's a lot of tension back and forth, you know.
Well, I will tell you, because everyone doesn't do it with skill. So that's just how it is. And I will tell you that you did it with skill, because I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And then, whoa, what's going on here? Yeah. So you certainly caught me by surprise. And I was like, wow, this is interesting. Plus, it's a book to really think about. It's a book to really reflect on.
Well, you know, I'm very, very happy to hear you say that, because more than anything else, I mean, that's the reaction that pleases me most, is when people say, you know, you don't read this thing and close and go, wow, that was a really great read. And then you move on to the next book on your to be read pile. I love when people say, you know, I'm still thinking about this. There's a writer friend of mine. I don't know if you're familiar with Dwayne. And I always have trouble pronouncing his last name, but it's Swarovski, I believe is how you pronounce
Heard it. Heard of him, yes.
Yeah, and Dwayne is a brilliant crime writer. He's a super smart guy. And very sadly, he lost a teenage daughter not too long ago. And as I was writing my book, I knew that I was going to run it past him, because the one thing I did not want to do, the one thing I did not want to do in writing this book, was to misrepresent in any way what that experience is like for a parent to lose a child. And I sent it to him as soon as I was done. I asked him, you know, would he be kind enough to read it for that purpose? And what he essentially came back with was, you know, I closed the book on Wednesday and I've been thinking about it ever since. You know, it's taken me this long to come back to you and tell you what I think, because I've been thinking about it ever since. And that I've gotten that reaction from a number of readers to this point where they're thinking about it, you know, days, weeks after they've read it. That's exactly what I want, because this book is not so much intended to answer the questions that I'm asking, but just pose the questions that I'm asking and to leave you thinking, okay, this is one way those questions could be answered, but gee, maybe there are multiple others, you know? That's really the reaction I wanted more than anything else. So if you say you read the book and you're thinking about it, you know, many days afterwards, I'm a very happy author. That's exactly what I wanted.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show, Gar Anthony Haywood, author of In Things Unseen. What's your website?
It's my name, garanthonyhaywood.com.
Thank you very much for being a guest on KAZI Book Review.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Hopton.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. I'm Hopton Hay. Subscribe to us under Hopton Hay Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many other sources of podcasts. If you like this interview, be sure to rate it. Rate it a 5. Give us 5 stars. You can follow KAZI Book Review on Twitter under @KAZI Books. You can also follow us under Facebook under KAZI Book Review with Hopton Hay. And you can also follow us on Instagram under KAZI_book_review. Thank you once again for listening to the KAZI Book Review podcast.